Another trooper had been contacted by an intermediary and had turned down a job offer, saying he couldn't uproot his family, even though the offer was tempting. The offer of the security consultant position was something that got my attention, because I had actually thought about seeking the job if George Saunders ever retired. But George seemed to go on and on like the Energizer Bunny. During the Bush administration, the job meant something, and it looked like an attractive post. But now, to take Craig's offer would mean immediate compromise. The administration had already neutered the position, and now, maybe, they were using it to bribe me. Of course, I also knew that by turning down the offer, I would become a marked man by the Clintons. Maybe they thought they could buy an FBI agent, like they had bought a state trooper in Arkansas. I was 6 months from retirement, and I was looking for a new job. Now I'd received my first offer, from the Clinton administration. But I had resolved I wouldn't remain in the Clinton White House 1 day past my retirement date. I'd come to the White House to get away from crooks and drug dealers, and now I was surrounded by a White House staff full of people who had been major drug buyers, or maybe worse. One only had to look at Clinton associates like Little Rock businessman Dan Lassiter, who was convicted of cocaine distribution and later pardoned by then-Governor Clinton, and whose former business partner is current Clinton Director of White House Management and Administration Patsy Thomason, responsible for drug testing at the White House. Or at the cocaine distribution convictions of Clinton's half-brother or of Surgeon General Jocelyn Elder's son, to get a hint of possible murky depths. If I had to guess, about 10% of the persons coming to the Bush White House had tried an illegal drug, which was about a third of the national average, and it was almost always marijuana, and only once. Prior use of cocaine was very rare. Use of more serious drugs was unheard of. The illegal drug use was invariably confined to an individual's college days. Though the age breakdown in the Bush and Clinton administrations was probably about the same, illegal drug use in the Clinton administration was much higher and not confined to minor drugs like marijuana. Generally, if marijuana was used, it was not confined to the college years either. In fact, a striking number of cases began to emerge in which the use of marijuana, once started in high school or college, continued into one's 20s, 30s, and sometimes even 40s. We were talking about decades of illegal drug use. There was another important difference between the Bush and Clinton staffs. In the Bush administration, more of the younger post-baby boom staffers had managed to get through college with no drug use at all. They were a reflection of the national downward trend in drug use inspired by Nancy Reagan's much-mocked but effective Just Say No campaign. But in the Clinton administration, it was harder to find young staffers who hadn't experimented with marijuana, cocaine, and heavier drugs. Apparently, they couldn't just say no. The minority of Bush applicants who experimented and admitted inhaling didn't try to defend their use of illegal drugs. They were invariably apologetic. Yes, I did smoke marijuana once or twice. I was in college and everyone was doing it, so I tried it. I stopped using marijuana after I left college, but I'm ashamed that I ever did it because it was stupid. I'm sorry agents like you were risking your lives fighting drug traffickers while I didn't have the guts to stand up to peer pressure. By contrast, the Clinton staffers, older or younger, made no apology for their illegal drug use, which was more extensive and included many heavy drugs like cocaine, crack, LSD, and methamphetamine. Many were actually in your face about it, using the FBI interview to try to debate me on the merits of making drugs legal. Of course, when I asked them how they obtained their drugs, the lies began. It was a rare Clinton staffer who ever purchased any drugs. Almost all of the Clinton staffers were given drugs by friends, or could not recall who gave them the drugs, or used the drugs at a party where they didn't really know anybody there. In the Bush administration, the Secret Service rarely, if ever, approved a permanent blue pass for applicants with confessed drug use beyond college. In fact, the Secret Service didn't want drug users anywhere within the complex, let alone near the president. But this was the Clinton administration, and things were going to be a lot different. Of all the character issues I investigated, I ranked casual drug use as no more important than simple dishonesty. Nevertheless, I had no criticism or argument for law enforcement officers taking a harder line, because many character problems were often driven by substance abuse. It was, in itself, a serious character flaw. In an effort to illustrate a typical Clinton-Gore illegal drug user, I will need to craft a composite person. I will call this young man Finu Linu, as in first name unknown, last name unknown. Last time I checked, lots of Mr., Mrs., and Ms. Linus were still working in the Clinton-Gore administration. Mr. Linu presented himself at the appointed time and sat in the hot seat, the chair where most of my interviewees were asked to sit. We went through the normal introductions, and I explained what we were going to do and the possible ramifications. Mr. Linu was told that it was a formal interview, an interview that would be reduced to a formal report and sent to the President's Council. I learned that, like so many other Clinton administration staff members, Mr. Linu had a personal and professional relationship to the Clintons. So many of the staffers had worked for the Clintons in Little Rock, had then worked on the campaign, and then had been invited to the White House. Many of the younger staff's parents had also worked for the Clintons. And so the loyalty to the Clintons was personal, professional, and familial. After graduating from college, Mr. Linu had been a waiter or pizza delivery boy. He then worked for the state of Arkansas before coming to the White House. We finally got to the section regarding the use of illegal substances. Mr. Linu had typed, "Some experimentation, most during college." He had not provided any further information. I needed to define his use so the reader of my report could judge Mr. Linu's exposure to illegal drugs and illegal activity, since the use of illegal drugs is an illegal activity. Mr. Linu, tell me more about your use of illegal drugs. What do you mean? Well, what you have indicated on the form doesn't tell us very much. For example, when did you start using illegal drugs? Look, I don't know what this has to do with anything. I haven't used drugs recently. I'm not using drugs now. Why should I tell the FBI about this anyway? It's none of your business. I'm a friend of Bill and Hillary's. Look, Mr. Linu, I couldn't care less about your drug use. Let me tell you something. You say you're a good friend of the President and First Lady. I'm going to give you the extension for the President's phone. If you wish, you can call him now and tell him that you don't want to talk to me about this drug use. But I think you should know that this investigation process is authorized by and for the benefit of the President of the United States. He had a choice whether to continue this process, and guess what? President Clinton signed the executive order that instructs me to ask you about your drug use. So what about your drug use? When did you first start using drugs? I used some marijuana in high school and then in college. Mr. Linu, from when to when did you use any illegal substance? Just give me the dates. Well, from 1986 to about sometime in 1992. It was grass, mostly. Mr. Linu, can you tell me how many times you used grass from 1986 to 1992? How am I supposed to know that? How often did you use it regularly? If you smoked grass once a week, then we can guess that you used grass about 52 times a year, and we can multiply that by your years of use. It's simple, Mr. Linu. Now, how many times did you use grass? I should point out that 52 times would be an extreme case. I never had such a case in the Bush administration, but this was the Clinton administration. Mr. Linu began to count the times in his mind. I was getting tired of Mr. Linu, real tired. He, like so many others, had simply disregarded the law in favor of satisfying a personal desire. This is called hedonism, I believe. I was a professional FBI agent, and I had seen so many things in my career that I didn't like, but I guess I had thought I wouldn't have to be around such people in the White House. Lord knows it was accepted that a law enforcement officer would have to be around dirtbags. That was part of the job. But in the White House? When Mr. Linu had an answer, I got ready to copy it down in my notes. Okay, I think I would say that I used marijuana about 400 times. Yeah, maybe 400. Maybe more. I paused, staring at my notes, at my pencil. I looked up to see if my partner Dennis had heard the answer. He had. Dennis was grinning like a polecat and shaking his head. He was trying to control the same response I was having, but he could smile because Mr. Linu had his back to him. This was it. I had spent many an hour with many of the Clintons' best and brightest, and I had heard so many things. They came to see me in T-shirts. They came to see me in jeans and earth shoes. They came to see me in short skirts without stockings or modesty. They came from Pizza Hut and Domino's and Joe's Bar and Grill and off campaign airplanes where they had been flight attendants. I couldn't stand it. I wanted to shout, "This is the White House, damn it!" I collected my thoughts and tried to regain my composure, but I just could not let this moment pass. "Mr. Linu, what did you conclude?" Mr. Linu looked puzzled. "Mr. Linu, what did you find out?" "I don't get it. What do you mean?" "Well, Mr. Linu, you described your drug use as experimental. Obviously, you conducted many experiments, maybe more than 400 experiments. Surely by now you have reached a scientific conclusion. Can you tell me what that might be? Have you concluded that you are addicted, Mr. Linu? Or have you concluded that you love marijuana?" "What is your scientific conclusion about drugs based on your experiments?" With that, Dennis broke up laughing, and so did I. Clearly, Mr. Linu was not amused, and while I had my laugh, I also figured this might be my last day at the White House. But by now, I had already decided that the Clinton White House was not my kind of White House. I had worked many years on the side of law and order, and I thought that my last years in the FBI should be spent someplace where my work meant something. Maybe someplace where my co-workers and associates shared my values. That place was certainly not the Clinton White House. Marijuana 100 times a year for 4 years? Mr. Linu was defined as a hardcore drug user by Clinton's own drug czar. Mr. Linu stood up. "This is not fair. This is not professional. I resent this." He moved toward the door. "Mr. Linu, look, I'm sorry. Why don't you sit back down and we'll move on and finish this thing so you don't have to come here again?" He sat down and we went through the last of it. We finally got to the loyalty question. Sure enough, when I asked him about his loyalty, he immediately concluded I was talking about Bill and Hillary, as almost all Clinton staffers did. Bush staffers understood this question to be about loyalty to the United States and the Constitution. They had it right. "No, Mr. Linu, this isn't about your loyalty to the President and the First Lady. That's taken for granted, or they wouldn't have hired you in the first place. I'm asking you about your loyalty to your country, the flag, the Constitution." "Oh, yeah, the country, sure." Mr. Linu was shown the door. Whenever Dennis and I saw Mr. Linu, we called him the scientist, in the hallway, he would glare at us, despite the supposed mellowing effects of his experimentation. A second example, whom I'll call Balls O'Leary, another composite, will serve to illustrate another well-represented type of Clinton staffer. Balls was a middle-aged guy who had graduated from college in the early 1970s, and then basically hung out, as he put it, for about a decade. Then he took a job on the Hill in one of the more liberal House or Senate committees, or maybe he worked for a public interest group, an environmental law firm, or a women's rights group. Balls came up to my office. In the course of the interview, I asked him about an arrest in the 1970s for possession of an illegal substance. He said, "You know, man, that long hairs like me got rousted all the time." "Oh, you had long hair? That's it?" "Yeah, that's it. You know, man, you cops didn't like people with long hair in those days." Well, I thought, I guess he's got me there. It's true. As a young FBI agent, I really didn't like guys with long hair, because they were usually the violent felons I was trying to track down, and a lot of them smelled bad. "But what about your arrest? Tell me about it." He explained that he was pulled over by a redneck cop in a northern state. How is that possible? and the cop pulled him over only because he had long hair. And then the cop made an illegal search of his car and found, of course, somebody else's marijuana. He was arrested, and the cop did not advise him of his rights. Can you imagine that? So there it was. I wrote it all down and sent it in to my headquarters. At about the same time, an agent was interviewing O'Leary's ex-wife about this victim of police brutality. She had quite a different story. According to her, Balls was really a head, a serious user of any and all kinds of drugs. On top of that, he was an alcoholic. On top of that, he used to beat the snot out of her on a regular basis. Others we interviewed echoed his ex-wife's claims. I received these additional reports, and I admit I wasn't surprised by what I read. After more than 20 years in the FBI, I was pretty good at sizing people up, and I knew that Balls had more strikes against him than just long hair. I called him up and told him to come to my office immediately. He meekly complied. He came in and sat down. "What's up? What's wrong?" "Nothing much, just lying to an FBI agent, which is a federal felony for openers." I began, "Look, we have some real problems with what you told me last time, Balls. We've talked to quite a number of your former associates. They claim you had a real history of substance abuse and that you were an alcoholic. Did you use marijuana on a regular basis? Did you use cocaine, LSD, mushrooms, speed, whatever you could get your hands on, as these former friends of yours have claimed?" Balls was red-faced. "I cannot believe this. This is so Kafka-esque." Nevertheless, I was able to extract the required confession out of Balls without electrodes or rubber hoses. But by that point, I was pretty sure that he would be at the White House on the day that I retired anyway. You know what? He was. Another composite, I'll call him Willie, was a middle-aged fellow and a mid-to-high-level staffer who also had a long history of illegal drug use. Nothing on the scale of Mr. Linu or Balls O'Leary, but his use was just a little more recent. Like, you know, during the campaign. He was high enough on the food chain to have his own office. I interviewed him there. I found the same perpetual smirk that told me that he was in the know about the fix being in on the FBI investigations. No matter what we found, he was one of the chosen and would be rubber-stamped by the counsel's office for even the most sensitive post with access to classified material. I came to the section about drugs and noted that he had listed use in late summer of 1992. "Well, Willie, I see we have some recent marijuana use here. What about it?" "Yeah, sure. We were on the campaign, you know, and, like, some friends of mine had tickets to a rock concert, you know? They invited me along, and, you know, they told me that they, like, knew the band well. We had front row seats. At a break in the concert, the band leader leaned down and invited us up to his hotel room, you know, like after the concert and everything. We went up there, and there was the band, and some others sitting around a bong pipe. What was I supposed to do, man?" It was not my place to lecture a man in his 30s working for the then governor of Arkansas about all the reasons why he might have excused himself from that room. If he didn't understand the reasons, and he clearly didn't, then what could I possibly tell him? I took notes of what he said. I finished the rest of the interview, and he saw me to the door. Then he said something I will never forget. "The things we'll be able to tell our grandchildren." I thought he was talking about working in the White House for the President of the United States. He said, "Just think, I'll be able to tell my grandchildren that I smoked pot with the Great Whatever Band." The White House staff did meet some standards. They met the standards that the Clintons set. If those standards were low, if they reflected the morality of the counterculture, then the Clintons are the only ones who can be blamed. This was proven to me beyond a reasonable doubt by the individuals Hillary chose to run the background adjudication process of the counsel's office: Bill Kennedy, Craig Livingstone, and their respective staffs. Associate Counsel Bill Kennedy was responsible for keeping persons of questionable character away from the White House. But as a gatekeeper, he wasn't terribly strict. For one thing, he didn't seem to regard serious drug abuse as a security risk. In one case, Kennedy summoned George Saunders to his office. He told Saunders that during a background investigation, a staffer had admitted to serious illegal drug use over an extended period, including recently. Kennedy asked George how he would approach the case. If he had to decide whether to keep or reject the staffer, what would he do? George said he would get him out of the complex immediately. Kennedy was surprised. Why should the staffer be denied access to the White House or a security clearance? Saunders pointed out that the staffer was not some kid who had been experimenting in college. He was a middle-aged man who should have known better. The drugs in question were hard drugs, not just marijuana. Kennedy thanked Saunders and said he wouldn't deny the staffer access or clearance. I can hardly fire somebody for being honest to the FBI, now can I? This was probably a test, and if it was, George obviously failed it. After that, George's participation in the security program was greatly curtailed. The staffer, by the way, is still on board. Need another example? On 27 September 1993, Craig Livingstone called me to discuss the new student interns. One intern working in the security office had expressed an interest in becoming an FBI agent. She had attended the briefing I'd given and was interested in learning more about the job. Craig wanted me to know that he had been very firm with her about not wasting the FBI's time. Gary, I told her that she needed to understand that the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, and other such agencies are very straight and would require full disclosure about her background, including a polygraph. I told her that she could not hide her past. I mean, it isn't like the White House, where you can use drugs before and skate past other indiscretions and still work here. I hung up the phone and stared out the window. There it was, the MHT. Incidents like these convinced me that word had trickled down to the Clinton staff that the system was rigged, and it didn't matter if we found their paperwork to be incomplete, illegible, or downright fraudulent. They knew the FBI and Secret Service agents were just paper tigers. I didn't know it in the beginning, but they knew it, and they laughed at us. Yes, a few token staffers were fired, mostly for financial problems we discovered in their backgrounds. But these were the little people, the secretaries and clerks. The big fish remained in place, and they were the ones who were the most worrisome. They were the ones who most often posed a clear and present danger to the security of the White House, and, from our perspective, to national security. In November 1993, I met with Congressman Charles Rangel of Harlem, New York. One of his staffers who had worked on the Select Committee on Drugs was moving over to the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Congressman Rangel had known and supervised this staffer for years and was a key interview in my FBI spin. Congressman Rangel arrived just a few minutes late, but was apologetic and made an effort to make me feel at ease. He was friendly, warm, and seemed sincere. While I was waiting for the congressman, I had some conversations with his polite and friendly staff, and I thought to myself how much more welcoming they were than the Clinton staff. Congressman Rangel had a reputation for being very liberal, and the very liberal liberals I had met and interviewed usually treated FBI agents with suspicion, if not hostility. But Congressman Rangel was different. "Well, what brings the FBI down here today? Good to see you," Congressman Rangel said, extending a big hand for a firm handshake. He had a twinkle in his eye, and no sign of any Clinton-esque hostility. I explained my mission, and we got down to business. I asked my questions, and he gave me good, honest answers. I thought as I sat there, man, did I make the right decision to spend more time on Capitol Hill and away from the Clinton White House. Congressman Rangel was helpful and professional. This was the way my job was supposed to work, and had worked, in the Bush administration. "Gary, do you mind if I call you Gary? How do you like your new FBI director?" "I'm very hopeful, Congressman. He seems like a decent and intelligent man. Best of all, he's a former agent, and I think that experience will serve him and us well, sir." Louis Free wasted no time getting up here to pay a courtesy visit. and I told him that I wanted to see the FBI maintain its very strong presence in the drug war, what's left of the drug war since Bill Clinton got hold of it. Clinton called me to let me know he was bringing out-of-town Brown from New York to serve as his drug czar. That's before he gutted the drug czar's office, of course. I said, "Bill, what in the world are you doing to me? I got kids getting shot by kids, and you're spending all of your time on NAFTA, gays in the military, and now you're doing this, hiring a lightweight for a heavy-duty job." And he says to me, "Charlie, you're talking about apples and oranges." And I said, "No, Mr. President, I'm talking about oranges and oranges. All of these yuppie college kids and Wall Street types are having their nose candy, keeping the cocaine flowing right into the inner city where it's turned into cheap crack. The damn rich get to have their recreational drugs while my people die in the streets. And in the meantime, you want to raise the quality of life in Mexico and stick me with out-of-town Brown?" The congressman and I had a long talk about drugs and crime, and it was clear to me that he was very concerned, knowledgeable, and astute. He didn't believe in playing games with drug smugglers, sending them to treatment programs or halfway houses. He thought they belonged in the slammer, period. Our talk continued. "Gary, did you know that Janet Reno was supposed to be the drug czar, but when the president and Hillary botched up the AG appointments, they had to switch Reno over to Justice? She's all for the drug court concept, you know. Rehabilitation without punishment or a criminal record. It's nonsense." "Congressman Rangel, sir, can you tell me how you know that, about Janet Reno being drug czar?" That was quite a promotion, I thought, from drug czar to AG. It might explain why she took the unprecedented step of firing all U.S. attorneys shortly after her appointment. She wouldn't want to be shown up by U.S. attorneys more aggressive than she was, not to mention that it would slow down investigations into Democratic Congressman Dan Rostenkowski, point man for Hillary's health care plan, and into Whitewater and other Little Rock mysteries. "Sure I can. The president told me that. And when he moved Janet Reno to AG and brought in Lee Brown as drug czar, I said, 'Mr. President, I think you are making a big mistake. Lee Brown didn't do anything when he was up in New York, and he ain't going to do anything down here.'" I learned Congressman Rangel had a background in law enforcement, and that gave us more to talk about. By this time, the staff was bobbing heads in and out of his office, signaling Congressman Rangel that his schedule was stacking up. He walked me to the door. "Gary, I've enjoyed talking to you, and you know what? From what you've told me about your job here and at the White House, I think you have the best job in the FBI. In fact, Aldrich, you got the best job I ever heard of, next to mine, of course." I thanked him, and as I walked away, I thought, "Congressman Rangel, I used to think so, too." On 9 December 1993, I met Lee Brown, the new director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, ONDCP. By the time I met him, ONDCP had been slashed by David Watkins to one quarter of its former size. The Clintons had changed the direction of the drug war from prevention and prosecution to treating drug abuse as a mental disorder. By the time I met Lee Brown, article after article had appeared in magazines and newspapers suggesting the Clintons were sufficiently soft on drugs that they might consider legalizing them. But when Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders broached the idea, coincident with her son's arrest on serious drug charges in Arkansas, the administration was stung by the national backlash. Elders drew back, and the idea of legalizing drugs was effectively retired, at least until a second term. I was curious about what Director Brown would say about Elders and her theory. I asked him questions about the investigation that had brought me there. And then he opened the door by asking me what I thought of Louis Free, the new director of the FBI, and about changes at the FBI. And soon the conversation drifted into the issues related to drugs, as I knew it would. I asked, "What do you think of the Surgeon General's comments on legalizing drugs?" "I'm very unhappy with what she said. She should stick to her business and leave the matter of drugs to me. I think she did a lot of damage, and she should keep her personal ideas to herself. If she doesn't learn soon, she'll be looking for a job. By the way, I just met with Free, and I think he'll do a good job on drug control. I was curious to know what Director Brown thought about Congressman Rangel. I asked, did you see the debate between Congressman Rangel and William F. Buckley on McNeil Lehrer the other night? No, I didn't catch it. What did they say? Congressman Rangel criticized the administration, saying it was inactive in the war on drugs and making things worse. Ah, Charlie Rangel. He thinks he's still running a drug committee over on the Hill. He hasn't figured out that that's in the past. He's made it his life's work, his agenda, Brown said with undisguised derision. Under Brown's leadership, the ONDCP's mission shifted from stopping the flow of drugs and locking up the smugglers to putting people who frequently didn't want to kick drugs into drug treatment programs, with predictable, unsatisfactory results. Drug abuse by young people jumped dramatically during the first years of the Clinton administration, no doubt in part because the users, the heads, were now running the bully pulpit. They were in domestic policy positions in the Clinton administration. There was even one charter member of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, or NORML, working in the White House. And this staffer, no volunteer but a federal employee, claimed to be a close personal friend of Hillary Rodham Clinton. Nobody ever asked Hillary if she had smoked dope or if she had ever inhaled. But Hillary was running the entire domestic policy machine at the White House. So, under the circumstances, why was it so important to know if Bill inhaled? While, for me, the war on drugs and fighting crime were matters of law enforcement, for the Clinton administration, it seemed a matter of politics. One day I received a call from Jack Quinn, Vice President Gore's new chief of staff. Quinn is now counsel to the president, having moved steadily up as vacancies have occurred. Quinn and I had talked several times of my interest in stemming the tide of violent crime. He knew I was interested in doing anything I could to assist in this effort, including sharing my thoughts with the domestic policy people in the Clinton administration who would be in a position to influence the administration's stance on crime and what to do about it. Of course, I had explained to Quinn, I am just one FBI special agent, and I don't speak for the agency. But if there is anything I can tell you about my experiences with the criminal justice system, I'd be happy to. After all, 20 years of chasing crooks and doing a pretty good job of it was worth something, wasn't it? Quinn told me that he had sent a memo over to Carol Rasko, assistant to the president for domestic policy, and she had agreed that I should talk to the administration's crime expert, Jose Cerda, a senior policy analyst. Now, I knew that Jose Cerda was the brother of Clarissa. I'm not a secretary, Cerda, the Watkins deputy who had barked at me that first day after the inauguration, but I couldn't hold that against him. So I skipped lunch and met the Clintons' 27-year-old senior crime policy analyst. Oh, he was well-educated, at Harvard Law School. But how did he get to be the administration's crime czar? It turned out that his only experience with law enforcement was as the Clinton campaign's political liaison with law enforcement groups, and as a campaign advisor on crime policy. Oh, yeah, and he had a cousin in Chicago who's a cop. We talked for a while, and then he gave me the Clinton smirk. Between you and me, during the campaign, we realized that Clinton's media reputation for being tough on crime was an absolute gift. And man, we didn't look a gift horse in the mouth. Only we were scared. We kept waiting for the Bush campaign to drop the crime bomb on Clinton, because we felt vulnerable. If they opened the record, they could have blown us away on crime. But it never happened. He was right. I went back and counted President Bush's campaign speeches. Of the hundreds he made, his advisors had given him a grand total of 2 on the subject of crime, and neither one of them went after Clinton's record, and you didn't have to look hard to find holes in it. For example, Governor Clinton had given a pardon to his good friend Dan Lassiter, a convicted drug smuggler and the person who supplied the president's half-brother Roger with cocaine. President Clinton had brought Patsy Thomason, Lassiter's business partner, to the White House to be his director of management and administration, and a special advisor to the president. These were very strong signals about where this president stood on the issue of illegal drugs. Look, Jose, I've been in this business a long time. I am telling you that people are absolutely fed up with crime, especially violent crime. And from my experience, I know there is only one way to get control of the situation, and that's to lock them up and throw away the key. Well, Gary, you got to understand one thing about the Clinton administration. We're a house divided about what to do about crime. Some say lock them up. Some say give them more help when they're young. The root causes people are winning the argument here. We finished up our talk and made plans to talk again, after the selection of a new FBI director. Sessions was just about finished, but he was the only one who didn't seem to know it. Before I left, Serda gave me a prediction. The Republicans have always owned this tough-on-crime issue, Gary, but we're going after it, and we're going to take it away from them. Watch and see. I didn't care who owned the issue. As a professional in law enforcement, I just wanted something done on the issue I cared about most. But after Vince Foster's death, I stopped participating in crime discussions at the Clinton White House. Instead, I avoided any issue not directly related to background investigations. I could see big trouble ahead, and I didn't want to have any part of it. Many of my permanent staff buddies were taking identical positions. We climbed into our foxholes, hunkered down, tightened the straps on our helmets, and waited for the incoming. One day in early March 1993, I walked into the Office of Presidential Scheduling to talk to Mike LaFrano about a background investigation. He had been given the deputy slot. His office had the new Clinton staff look. The office walls were bare. Partially unpacked cardboard boxes were spread haphazardly on the floor. On the filing cabinet sat a motorcycle helmet. Half-empty coffee cups were strewn about. The place looked like a college dorm room. Mike LaFrano was looking right at me and was talking to me, but his words made no sense at all. He waved at me while he talked, and I wondered if he had gone crazy. I knew scheduling the president could be stressful, but... Of course, he wasn't talking to me at all. He was wearing a miniature headset, like a telephone operator might wear, and he was speaking to someone, somewhere, about an upcoming presidential visit. I gestured an offer to leave, inasmuch as he clearly was not ready to talk to me. I was annoyed that I'd been sent into his office without being told he was on the phone. But LaFrano indicated I should stay. My meeting with Mike LaFrano was short and to the point. He was a Clinton loyalist, of course. But even Mike LaFrano reached his limit. On 29 September 1993, he called me and asked if I remembered him. Sure I did. Gary, do you mind if I ask you a question? How do you FBI guys do your jobs here in the White House? Well, Mike, we just call folks and line up interviews, and Mike interrupted. No. I'm asking you how you can clear people through the security system when there are no standards. What are you trying to say, Mike? Gary, I'm telling you, I know a lot of these people, and I cannot believe that they are here in the White House. Don't you people have any standards at all? When I felt, like Mike LaFrano, that the Clinton administration had thrown every standard to the wind, I did what I could to get away from the White House, to fulfill one of my other FBI responsibilities. One of these was brushing up on my marksmanship. FBI agents were required to train in the use of firearms several times a year, and I always looked forward to a day at our training facility at the Marine Base in Quantico, Virginia. It was a chance to get outside, get some fresh air, and visit with agents I hadn't seen for a while. We were well into the new Clinton administration, and we knew we had a problem on our hands. The agents who conducted the spin investigations were the first to see the disturbing trends and patterns of the new administration. Next to see the problems were the analysts at FBI headquarters, who received the reports and saw the character flaws we were unearthing. Drugs, bizarre sexual behavior, failure to pay taxes, failure to honor financial obligations, severe credit problems, bankruptcy, civil suits, liens, loan defaults, failure to repay federally funded student loans, There was a long list of character issues. Of course, drug use stood out, mostly because it was blatant, and there was a pattern of serious long-term and recent use. Lifestyle was also an issue that we had to address, because homosexuals were now present in the White House in large numbers. This created special problems for our background investigations, because we were still required to ask if a person was homosexual and investigate those who lied about it. Did the Clintons care if there was a potential for blackmail? It was hard to think they did, especially after having made gays in the military their first big policy fight. And there were certainly plenty of homosexuals in the White House who flaunted rather than tried to hide their sexual persuasion. I remember walking out my door one day to see two men with identical ponytails, earrings, turtlenecks, tight-fitting jeans, and jean jackets holding hands. And it wasn't that unusual a sight. In the Bush administration, candidate staffers were so well scrubbed, we were virtually reduced to asking questions like, "Did you actually see him take the pen?" Now, we were being asked to look the other way when we found serious character issues that would previously have meant immediate dismissal. During a break in target shooting, some of the spin agents confronted me. "What the hell is going on at the White House, Gary?" "Look, Joe, don't ask me. I've never seen anything like it." "Are you sure you haven't seen these people before? Think about it," said an agent who had worked for years in foreign counterintelligence. "Kill the pigs? Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Cong are gonna win? That's who they are, Gary. They're the people we used to arrest." I remember it was a chilly day. The Army fatigue jacket had been borrowed from the rack at the Quantico training facility where we had received our briefing the night before. We were not yet full-fledged FBI agents, but it was an all-hands-on-deck situation. Black armband, red headband, army jacket. I looked just like a Vietnam vet against the war. I fit right in, and it was right on. We had fanned out. None of us had a partner. We were to walk around and observe. If we overheard any plans to storm the White House or the Department of Justice, we were to get on a payphone and report it immediately. I also had a camera, but I didn't stand out because lots of the protesters had brought cameras. I collected a few tracts related to various radical splitter groups and listened as SDS leaders from around the country called for overthrowing the government by violence if necessary. The Washington Mall was packed with 500,000 disaffected young people. At one point, I saw park police on horseback being assaulted by rocks and bottles. One rider was thrown to the ground. The young crowd cheered and shouted, "Off the pig! Off the pig!" They surged forward as a mob. The park police, 100 strong, surged right back. That riot having been stemmed, I moved on down the mall. There were Viet Cong flags everywhere, and many protesters were carrying Chairman Mao's Little Red Book, very popular reading on campuses in those days. The red headbands were not about war wounds. The headbands were the communists' way of identifying each other. Every so often I would stop and listen to the ranting. Some of the rhetoric was about getting the U.S. out of Vietnam. Most was about killing the pigs, effing Nixon, burning down the White House, storming the Pentagon, taking over the Department of Justice, and taking revenge on the hated FBI and CIA. They shouted about the necessity of offing undercover FBI agents and informants. I raised my arm in a power salute with the others and chanted, "Right on, death to the scum FBI pigs." I came to a police barricade. There were D.C. police on one side of the line and a riotous crowd on the other. They were nearly toe-to-toe. The police looked scared but determined. Many were as young as I. The rioters were in their faces, screaming obscenities, warning that their days were numbered. They would be drawn and quartered, hung from lampposts, hunted down and shot in the head. Rocks and bottles started flying from somewhere back in the crowd. The police retreated a step or two and donned gas masks. They pulled pins from tear gas canisters and tossed them high in the air. Other police loaded tear gas guns, ready for total assault. Everyone started screaming, and the protesters bolted in all directions, howling with rage. The hatred I saw in the protesters' eyes was incredible. They wanted anarchy. They wanted violence. They wanted Washington in ruin, the Constitution in flames, simply because they believed the government was repressive, corrupt, and beyond repair. Earlier that same day, in another time zone, 500 protesters from Oxford, led by William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, marched on the American embassy. Many carried little red books and Viet Cong flags, shouting, "Down with the United States," and "Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh." It was a coordinated effort set up by the Vietnam Moratorium Committee, or VMC, an organization run by Sam Brown, a good friend of Bill Clinton. On this side of the Atlantic, I stood at a police barricade and hoped the officers would be able to return safely to their wives and children that night. On the other side of the Atlantic, the future President of the United States was leading a march against his own country's embassy. Chapter 8. Travel Office Tragedy. Rules for Radicals. An organizer working in and for an open society is in an ideological dilemma. To begin with, he does not have a fixed truth. Truth to him is relative and changing. Everything to him is relative and changing. He is a political relativist. George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior. Be not hasty to believe flying reports to the disparagement of any. When I was being trained as a new agent at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, the instructors warned us about abusing our power. We had the power to arrest, the authority to shoot to kill, and the devastating power to investigate a person's past and current activities. The mere existence of an FBI investigation can lead to an individual's personal, professional, and financial destruction. An actual indictment is like dropping a house on someone. FBI agents, at least senior ones, are well aware of this, and they use their power wisely. We have seen how businesses can go under, banks fail, marriages dissolve, and prosecutors become famous and defense attorneys become wealthy as a result of a single visit from an FBI agent. Imagine, if you will, that the President of the United States and his spokesperson have announced that you are suspected of a criminal act, and that he has ordered the FBI to solve the obvious crime that has been committed within the walls of the White House. Can you imagine the impact that the President's allegation might have on your life? If the FBI has enormous power, what kind of turbo boost to that power results when the President gives the orders and the encouragement? That power was turned on 7 good and innocent men in the White House Telegraph and Travel Office because the Clintons believed in the spoils system, stripping loyal employees of their jobs and giving those jobs to friends. Billy Dale's window of vulnerability was that he paid foreign customs officials the fees they required to ensure that on presidential trips the media's boxes and bags sped through customs without delay. The nightmare scenario he was trying to avoid was having a president ready to sign a historic agreement in some foreign country, pen poised, waiting for the photo dog stuck at the airport. Why the media didn't deal with this problem themselves is not known to me, but Billy took the fall for it. Maybe that's why so many media giants like Sam Donaldson showed up to testify in Billy's defense. They knew what had really happened, and they felt sorry for Billy. So did I. When Dennis heard that the travel office was under the microscope at the instigation of David Watkins and his assistant, Catherine Cornelius, he went to Kennedy and told him about the travel office media customs delay problem. He told Kennedy that this less-than-savory arrangement was not a scheme to line the pockets of travel office personnel. It was a mixture of realpolitik and courtesy to the media. But Kennedy and Cornelius had their orders to create some vacancies. Hillary Clinton was pressuring her counsel's office and Watkins, who ran the travel office, to take action. "We need the slots," is how one memo recalls her words. The trick was how to open those slots without inviting the same sort of criticism that greeted the meat cleavering of the grandmothers in the correspondence office. The travel office guys were good at what they did. They had been in the White House for decades. But most of all, these guys were loved by the media. Why? Well, not only did they pay the fees demanded by the foreign customs officers, but they also got the media hotel rooms when, officially, there weren't any to be had, and made sure that the media weren't left stranded by canceled flights or bungled hotel reservations or any other travel disasters normal people put up with. In short, the media were treated presidentially by Billy Dale's crew. In my meeting with a very emotional Craig Livingstone on 11 August, he described a meeting attended by Watkins, Foster, Kennedy, and himself, wherein he argued against involving the FBI to investigate rumors of suspicious activities in the travel office. There was no mention of missing monies or gross mismanagement, which was eventually claimed by the White House as the reason for firing the seven. Livingstone blamed David Watkins for the stupid idea of bringing in the FBI, but some of the others must have agreed with him. According to Livingstone, they knew of no evidence that would prove any illegal acts. The point was to force the FBI into an investigation that might discover wrongdoing that took place during the Reagan and Bush administrations. Then the Clintons could get rid of the seven, create the slots Hillary wanted, and leave the press without much room for protest. After all, who would defend seven assumed criminals investigated by the FBI? Bill and Hillary's good buddies, Mr. and Mrs. Harry Thomason, would then get the travel contracts, worth millions of dollars. And Catherine Cornelius, who was already complaining about Watkins' abusive behavior, could get a much better job in the administration, away from Watkins. How had White Houses of the past handled internal problems, including fraud, corruption, and the like? Simple. With a very efficient and quiet Secret Service investigation. The Secret Service was good at these kinds of investigations, and, more important, it was their jurisdiction, not the FBI's. Why didn't they use the Secret Service then? Because Secret Service agents had been traveling with Billy Dale and his crew for years and had never seen even the slightest evidence of theft or fraud. What else could the White House do? They could have called the spin unit at FBI headquarters and ordered a review of the background investigations of the travel office, focusing on lifestyle issues related to credit and living within one's means. In the Bush administration, I had handled a number of such cases, which were accelerations of routine updates. The counsel's office would advise me of additional information or new allegations that I would then investigate. This was an appropriate legal use of the FBI, and an effective means of clearing up personnel problems. The FBI spin would be submitted to the White House counsel, who would then decide a course of action. But all of this implied allegations that truly deserved investigation, something the Clinton administration didn't have. Clinton's White House counsel's office certainly knew about accelerating routine background checks of staffers because they'd used it before, and, as in the travel office investigations, with ulterior motives. I know because early in the Clinton administration, I began receiving requests for investigative updates on resident staffers, years before such updates would normally occur. I asked Craig Livingstone why, especially given that the administration showed so little interest in having anyone else, especially new political appointees, investigated in the normal fashion. Have they done something wrong? Are they accused of anything? No, we've just lost their files, so we need to update them. I know an easier way, I said. Getting copies of the files isn't a problem. Just give me a list of the cases, and I'll have the FBI spin unit send you a new copy. I'd done plenty of investigations of resident staff, and I didn't remember any serious issues coming up. More than that, I had enough work to do without taking on entirely unnecessary new investigations. Craig looked pained. I'll think about it. Later, I got a call from my supervisor telling me that the clock was running on requested update investigations of resident staff, and I had better meet my deadlines. So, that was that. The real reason for the updates, I later discovered, was not because the files had been lost, but